you think we can make it? Will it be different or just the same? How long can we keep escaping? How long can we keep escaping? How long can we keep escaping into another prison?
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm Dab Stedman, your host, and my guest today is Gail Hunt, the founder and president of the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition. We'll be talking today about the controversial roundups of wild horses in the western states, along with some ideas for protecting these icons of freedom. Good morning, Gail, and thank you for calling in today.
Hi. Good to be here, and I really appreciate you inviting me and for realizing that wild horses are animals.
They're animals, and they're very important ones. Gail, as you know, there has been a real battle raging in the West for decades now between the Bureau of Land Management, the ranching community, and animal advocates all over the rights of wild horses and burros to continue to roam free on our public lands. And in 2002, you jumped right into the middle of it. Please tell us a little bit about your background and why you started an organization here in Oregon to address the situation.
Okay, it really goes back to about 1980, and I hope I don't lose your audience when I say that I was a bureaucrat with the Forest Service for 27 years, although I wasn't a very good bureaucrat. My first job was at the Big Summit Ranger District on the Ochoco National Forest east of Prineville. My very first foray into Forest Service at all. And they had a herd of wild horses up there that they were just really starting to manage according to the Wild Horse and Burro Act. And what I observed then was a crew of people that, even though they didn't really know where to start, they had no direction, they were trying. They were experimenting with good ways to capture them. They were doing the compliance checks. They were keeping good adoption records, and they cared about the horses. And I distinctly remember a trip up the road in a snowcat when the snow was very deep with the range guy, and he wasn't up there to trap the horses. He was just up there to feed them. And I have memories of nothing but good things done by the Forest Service at that period in time. And then I left after about 3 years and came back in 1992 to the same office, and I found a very, very different culture and attitude toward the horses.
In what way?
Well, I don't know if I even want to start relating that, because it isn't good. And that is really the answer to my question that you gave me: how did I get started in this? After about 10 years of observation and coming very close to losing my job trying to make change from the inside, I started this organization. And it was at that time kind of a triage response to deal with some of the issues that I knew had to be stopped, and I couldn't do it from the inside. So initially our goal was really to help the horses of the Ochoco, which is formerly the Big Summit Wild Horse Territory. But, of course, you have to care about the issues of all the horses, particularly if you want a sustainable policy to help your local horses. It has to come from the top down.
Okay, so what would you say that your group's mission is, their primary mission, and if you could just give us a few of your goals and objectives?
Well, naturally, it is to make sure that the local herd is cared for now and into the future, and that can mean anything from us doing the annual census to stepping in on an emergency basis when there's a single horse that needs help, whether it's in the forest or already out in the public sector somewhere, and we have to rehab him and basically save its life, to teaching people how to train their horses properly, education, putting on events, and right now it happens that we're assisting the Ochoco National Forest in rewriting the old 1975 Wild Horse Management Plan.
Boy, you've taken on quite a bit. And I know that in the past, I read on your website at least, that you have done some inventories of the wild horse herds as well.
Yeah, we do that for the local herd on an annual basis, and we do that with about usually about 90 volunteers on horseback camp throughout the herd management area. And we, of course, keep track of the horses all year long to make sure that's consistent with the numbers we find during the census.
Okay. Also on your website, you talk about one of your primary goals as making sure that there are viable populations of wild horses. What constitutes a viable population?
As with just about every issue involved in the greater issue, it depends on who you talk to. Because we know that we have to do some compromising here, we're going by geneticist Gus Cawthron of Texas A&M's recommendations that you don't have that anything less than 150 breeding horses, breeding adults. Now, we're right at that number of total horses right now, but it may be less than optimal, but I know under the circumstances and knowing local politics as I do, that's probably the best we're going to be able to hope for.
Okay, you're talking about 150 breeding horses in one herd management area?
Well, in our case, it isn't 150 adult horses. It's 150 to 160 total horses is what we counted in June. And that is on 27,000 acres of assigned territory. But in this case, it's timber and it's forage and it's wet, and it's, you can't compare that to the same number of acres out in the Oregon desert.
Okay, and so is that where you operate? And let me ask you, who are your supporters? You say you're a coalition. Who comprises your group?
We have a very small board by design, about six people right now, and for things like the census, we call upon that community of volunteers that are capable of doing that on horseback. And depending on what we need, we'll call upon various people. And we also integrate with other wild horse organizations. And we're part of the American Wild Horse Preservation Campaign. It's kind of a coalition of at least 60 wild horse advocacy groups around the nation.
Okay, because there are wild horses in, is it 10 western states?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, even long before you personally got involved, there was a very famous woman named Wild Horse Annie. And through her efforts, and I think it took her 10 or 20 years, finally a congressional act was passed to protect wild horses and burros. I understand that it's been amended quite a bit since it was passed in 1971. You want to talk a little bit about that congressional act and what it does do for the horses and what it doesn't do for the horses and burros now?
Yeah. First of all, Wild Horse Annie Velma Johnston was just an incredible exemplary human being. And if anyone is really wanting to know more about horses, they really have to start by reading about her. And there's an excellent, excellent synopsized biography of Velma Johnston on the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros website. Wild Horse Annie started that, and now that organization is being sustained by Karen Sussman. Anyway, what she was able to craft during the administration of Richard Nixon's presidency was really a very beautiful and I think perhaps intentionally vague statement about how much the horses mean to this nation as a species. Not just that they have a right to exist, but what they do for us as a people. And everything that was originally contained in that language is consistent with that attitude. And that held up until, it was passed in 71. In 1976, the first blow was struck where they started using helicopters to gather. When Annie started this, there weren't really helicopters in the picture, and that kind of came into on the horizon when a lot of Vietnam soldiers were skilled as pilots, and I think that it was just kind of a natural progression to use helicopters because you had that resource now. That was never the intent of the law.
Okay, now that brings us to the next point that I'd like to talk about. Let's talk about the government roundups now, as this is the main method used by the Bureau of Land Management to control the numbers of horses and burros living in the designated herd management areas. Just last month, another big roundup was ordered to remove up to 1,400 horses in Beatty's Butte, which is located in the southeastern part of our state. Can you tell us, in the first place, how does the Bureau of Land Management determine that a roundup is even necessary?
Well, I have to also preface this statement by saying that our Oregon BLM is known to other advocacy groups as the Nirvana of BLM. And I would have to agree with that. You might find our BLM folks doing a roundup because an entire range got burned up in a fire or something like that. But the typical roundup is all going to trace back to the magic AML, or appropriate management level numbers. Those numbers are subjective, to say the least, and it gives the agencies license to round up horses whether they actually need to or not. So it can usually be traced back to that. Yes, sometimes it's condition of range, obviously, but what we often miss as public is why is that range in that condition? Is it solely due to the horses? Is it due to drought conditions, climate change, livestock grazing, certainly? There are a number of other factors, but it can always be justified by that AML number. If they're significantly over that, then that's basically licensed to gather.
Okay, so is it the BLM that does population studies and assesses the state of the environment? Is that their duty to do that?
Either BLM or Forest Service, those are the two agencies that are mandated to protect horses. So, yes, it would be the agency's responsibility.
Does politics ever enter into the equation here?
I think we know the answer to that.
That was a loaded question.
Yes, it was. Yes, of course it does. And you know, you can't say the word politics without saying the word rancher. But again, we need to distinguish between the private land rancher and the public lands rancher. No one would contest that that's a big part of our Western culture, and we don't want to see it go away, certainly. But the public lands rancher is the one who is going to be sharing that piece of real estate with the wild horse and burros that we're required to protect.
So is this why the ranching community is so violently opposed to the mere presence of wild horses on the open rangelands?
Well, I think, to be fair, we would need to go back in time to when cattle first occupied, if you will, the western states back in the late 19th century. There were no laws. They didn't have the right to claim that land. It was wrong. It was destructive, and it was done with impunity. So millions and millions of cows and some sheep just basically took over the environment and the ecosystem of the entire West. And when it became a problem even to the ranchers and their livestock, then something had to be done, so the agencies were formed. But the agencies were staffed with ranchers. So you couldn't stick a tail hair in between the ranchers and the agencies at that time. So that entire culture has come forth, and it has become a de facto entitlement rather than the privilege to graze on public lands.
Because of the competition for food and water on the federal grazing allotments, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. And let me ask you, once the so-called excess horses have been removed from certain ranges, are the conditions on those ranges generally improved?
Now, that's a question that I would not presume to answer. Back in about 1990 or so, when the Government Accounting Office was the Government Accountability Office, they did a study and they said no, because you keep putting your cattle back on.
Yeah, that's what I understand, yeah.
But two, when you say excess, back to the original Wild Horse and Burro Act, in the original language, there was no such word as excess.
Yeah.
That was added.
Yes, yes, and a very important addition at that. Gail, we're going to take a little break now, so I'm going to ask our listeners to stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Yeah, we're back already, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. I'm Dab Stedman, and we're talking about wild horse roundups with Gail Hunt, who is the head of the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition. Gail, can you please describe for us what a typical roundup really looks like? What actually happens out there?
In the Ochocos, it would look like a big trap with a tripwire and nobody around, because we have trees and we can't use helicopters here. It just doesn't even work. But just about everywhere else, it usually looks like a very large wing trap narrowing down to a bunch of holding and sorting pens. And the helicopters are deployed to go out and find the horses and drive them back. And as far as what is the effect on the wild horses involved, it would really depend on a number of factors such as weather and terrain, distance, and probably more than anything, the quality of the helicopter pilots. They can make them go fast or they can let them go slow.
Now, I've read that the horses, a lot of them at least, become very stressed. There are injuries. There are spontaneous abortions with the mares, and sometimes even death follows the roundups. Are these things true?
Of course. I would also have to say, though, that if there is a humanely done roundup anywhere, it would occur in Oregon. And even so, we lost 16 horses during the Beatty's Butte Roundup, but no one can really know except the people immediately involved whether those were directly due to the stress of the process or whether those were horses that needed euthanized because of factors that had already occurred, such as long-standing injuries, broken legs. But yes, in some of them where the contractors and the BLM folks are less ethical, there is untold injury and death and stress.
Well, that sounds pretty brutal. Well, let me ask you now, what happens to the horses after they are rounded up and penned?
They go to one of several, we'll just say processing centers, although please don't construe that to mean that anything bad happens to them. Their processing means basically putting a tag around their neck and entering their freeze brand number into a record. They're usually dewormed and vaccinated. If they have any other issues, those are addressed.
Are the families of horses kept together?
Oh, no, certainly not. That's usually something that occurs during the penning process immediately following the gather, is that they are separated according to gender and oftentimes age.
And then
they probably aren't going to be back together ever, except for some of the younger foals.
And then they're shipped to these so-called adoption centers. Can you describe what an adoption center looks like or is like in terms of the living conditions for the horses there?
I don't have firsthand experience except for the Burns BLM Adoption Center, which is the same as a processing center. It's just a series of really, really large pens. And I will say that if you can live a tolerable life as a once wild horse, I can't really fault the way that they live in these centers. They get fed plenty, water is abundant, and unless it's just a an extremely mucky period or snowy period, then they do okay. That's really not where the problem lies, because the damage has already been done at that point.
Yeah. Are they exercised at all, or they just stand around in a pen all day?
They do whatever they want.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if I were interested in adopting a wild horse, how would I go about that? What are the eligibility requirements to do that?
You couldn't have any felony animal abuse charges. That's the first thing they'd look at. You have to prove by photograph or some other evidence that you have the proper facility. And with a horse that's right off the range, as opposed to one that you might get through one of the Mustang Heritage Foundation programs as a pre-trained horse, you would have to have at least 400 square feet of a pen, and that has to be a 6-foot fence, solid fence, not barbed wire, certainly. And then you have to have a three-sided shelter, and you have to prove that you know how to feed and care for a horse.
Okay, and can horses be sold for, adopted and then sold for commercial purposes?
Well, we could say no, but we also know that it happens.
And what happens to some of those horses then?
Well, we, of course, know the one that that has made the news recently that actually occurred some years ago. That was an anomaly. You know, I can't defend everything about the program, but that was never intended to happen. That was not malicious on anybody's part but the one who did it.
Is this, are you referring to when several, I don't know, was it 4,000 or 400? I can't remember. Horses wound up at a slaughterhouse. Is that what you're talking about?
If it's the same one that you're thinking of, it was closer to 1,800.
Okay.
But one thing that can happen and does is that you adopt a horse and then it really isn't yours for a period of 1 year. And there's supposed to be a compliance check by a volunteer. We've done plenty of them here. And just to make sure that the horse is being taken care of properly. If it isn't, that's the time we would troubleshoot and get involved and correct that. But when they send you your adoption application for a title, then really the only process involved there is that you get somebody to sign off on it. And it can be a farrier or a vet or somebody that says they're a farrier or a vet. And that's where the problem lies. Because then they are no longer property of the government, they're property of you, and you can do more or less with impunity whatever you want with that horse.
And there's probably very little follow-up at that point, I would imagine.
There's none. There can't be, really.
Okay. All right. Well, we've described some of the main problems with the roundups and the current system of managing wild horses on public land. So let's move forward now and discuss what measures could be taken to make life easier for these persecuted animals and to ensure their future viability. You've written, Gail, that the key to the long-term survival of the wild horses lies in their very origins. Can you give us a brief history of the horse in this part of the world to give us a better understanding of your meaning?
I'd be happy to. And I'm learning all the time. I was so ignorant going into that, and a week ago I was far more ignorant than I am today, and there's so much to learn. But what we do know, beyond any shadow of doubt, is that the modern wild horse evolved on this continent. That is proved beyond anybody's ability to refute it. You can check some facts on the Cloud Foundation website under education, and they really speak well to that factor. But then, it's a popular opinion in most disciplines right now to say, yeah, that might be true, but it went extinct approximately 10, 11, 12,000 years ago. And that's why people are resistant and agencies to say that these are native horses, because if they left, they lose that status. So our premise is they didn't leave. And there is just a huge mountain, a body of evidence that says that isn't true. And that's found in fossil records that not everybody is aware of, but that does exist. It's found in artifacts. It's found in petroglyphic evidence. It's found in oral tradition among the native peoples. It exists.
Yeah, well, please explain a little bit further why this classification of being a native wildlife impacts the present debate as to whether these horses have a rightful place on our rangelands or not.
According to the agencies, they're going to manage them whether they're native or not. But why it's important is, you and I know very well that the word feral is tantamount with the word non-native. So that's why we're not going to ever get anywhere in a debate over who is more deserving of this square inch of desert land, a non-native cow or a feral horse. If horses are irrefutably declared to be native, then that changes everything. It changes the entire power shift. It changes how every agency and every employee of that agency and every biologist, every ologist, has to suddenly view horses. Instead of just managing them peripherally and tolerating them, we would then have to do what we should have done decades ago, and that is figure out how we can recreate the environmental niche that this horse once filled and needs to fill again to everybody's benefit.
Well, that sure sounds like a big job. You have a lot on your plate there, you and the other groups that advocate for the wild horses. Despite everything you're doing, I think the pressure to remove the wild horses from the public lands will remain strong for a while yet. So what can your organization and other organizations do to save the wild horses for generations to come? Are there some things you're working on? I know that your website mentions birth control studies.
Right. And we should say as well that although there is definitely a war raging between public lands ranching and we horse advocates, they're not the only enemy. There is certainly mineral extraction, gas and oil, several other industries. And even if we were to resolve those conflicts, we still have population growth to address. So, yes, there are some things that should be done now with the technology that we currently have. But we also need to really be thinking outside of that fertility control box as it stands today. Currently, we have PZP, which is porcine zona pellucida. But we also have...
which is a type of birth control, right?
Yeah, we'll just say PZP. But there's another one that is lesser known that's being tested on the Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and that is a thing called Gonicon, and they are working in conjunction with BLM right now to see if there are unintended consequences. So we've got those two types of fertility control, but in addition, we need to change the behaviors of the horses as well, and the expert on that is Karen Sussman, who is Wild Horse Annie's protege that runs the ranch where she has several experimental herds, one of which is the Virginia Range, which came from Wild Horse Annie's original herd. And what she has learned is that if you leave the horses the heck alone, they do tend to self-regulate their populations. But you have to make sure that the stallion-to-mare ratio is not skewed heavily to the stallions. You have to make sure that you can actually observe those horses closely enough to weed out behavioral problems and get them corrected, which often results from trauma of capture and separation.
I see.
And the other thing that the National Park is doing is they are using a thing called low-stress livestock handling techniques rather than any kind of traumatic roundups, and it's working great for them.
Well, that's encouraging.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So what would you say your ideal vision for these iconic animals is, and are you hopeful for their future?
Ideally, what we need to see is a major shift in attitude amongst everybody involved. We need to, whether you believe these are native animals or not, we really need to study the contributions that the species can make to a functioning ecosystem, and we need to appreciate the value to America of these horses.
Yeah, okay, Gail, I see that we're running out of time, so just very quickly, if our listeners would want to support your work, which I'm sure they do, can you please give us your website or some other kind of contact information?
Sure. It's cowildhorse.org, O-R-G, And we're probably going to be a lot more responsive on our Facebook page, Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition.
Okay, great. I'll make sure I put that
information from there.
I'll be sure I include that contact information on our program page. Well, Gail, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you for educating us about the problems and prospects for the wild horses in Oregon. And good luck with all of your efforts to keep them roaming free on our public rangelands. This is Dab Steadman with Voices for the Animals, thanking you for listening to this interview with Gail Hunt, the founder of the Central Oregon Wild Horse Coalition. To hear this program or podcast from past programs, just go to our station's website at kboo.fm. And please plan to tune in again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now the KBOO News at noon for December 28, 2015. In local news, the State of Oregon Agricultural Department is proposing to spray up to 8,000 acres in the Portland area next year in order to eradicate the Asian gypsy moth. The Asian gypsy moth, considered to be a serious invasive pest, is not yet established in the Northwest. But in 2015, Oregon officials trapped 14 of the moths, and the state of Washington found 10 of the moths. This prompted a panel established by the two states to recommend aerial spraying of a natural insecticide called BKE, Bacillus thuringiensis cursteici. The state of Washington is proposing to spray more than 10,000 acres, including residential areas in Kent, Seattle, and Tacoma. In environmental news, in what is being called the worst environmental disaster since the Gulf oil wells blowout in 2010, the natural gas well leak continues unabated in California's San Fernando Valley. It is believed that the pipe from the well is broken somewhere between 500 feet deep and the actual well located 8,500 feet underground. More than 62 million cubic feet of methane is being released into the atmosphere daily. This release is equal to 8 coal-fired power plants